Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Brandon Allgood, Vice Chair of the Science and Technology Member-Led Forum here at the club, and your chair for this evening. We welcome our audience both physically present and listening in. Everyone should visit us at www.commonwealth.org. And it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers for this evening, Joel Premack and Nancy Abrams. Joel Premack is a professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He specializes in the formation of galaxies and the nature of the dark matter that makes up the matter in the universe. Joel received his bachelor's degree from Princeton in 1966 and his PhD from Stanford University in 1970. He was a junior fellow of the Society of Fellows of Harvard University. After helping to create what is now called the Standard Model of Particle Physics, Joel began work in cosmology in the late 70s and became a leader in the new field, particle astrophysics. He is one of the principal originators and developers of the theory of cold dark matter, which has become the basis for the modern picture of structure formation in the universe. With the support of the National Science Foundation, the NASA, and the Department of Energy, he is currently using supercomputers to simulate and visualize the evolution of the universe under various assumptions and comparing the predictions of these simulations to the latest observational data. Nancy Abrams received her Bachelor in the History and Philosophy of Science from the University of Chicago, her JD from the University of Michigan, and a Diploma in International Law from Escuela Libre del Derecho in Mexico City. She was a Fulbright Scholar and a Woodrow Wilson designate. Her writings have appeared in many journals, newspapers, and magazines, such as the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, The Environment, California Lawyer, and Science and Global Security. She has a long interest in the role of science in shaping politics and has worked in this area for a European environmental think tank in Rome, the Ford Foundation, and the Office of Technology Assessment for the U.S. Congress, where she co-invented a novel procedure called scientific mediation. She has consulted on its use for the state governments of California and Wisconsin, private corporations and organizations, and the government of Sweden, where scientific mediation has become standard procedure in the Ministry of Industry. For over a decade, Joel and Nancy have co-authored a number of prize-winning articles on quantum cosmology and Kabbalah, science policy, space policy, and the possible cultural impacts of modern cosmology. They have also been co-teaching a course at the University of California, Santa Cruz, entitled Cosmology and Culture, out of which came their latest book, The View from the Center of the Universe, which will be on sale after the talk in the library. Following the same vein of cross-disciplinary discovery that has led them to teach and write over the years, they are here this evening to give us a cosmological view of the human future. Please help me welcome Joel and Nancy.
I'm standing on a little step here to be able to see over this rather tall podium. It's a special pleasure to come here and be welcomed by Brandon. He neglected to mention that I was his PhD advisor. Until very recently, no one knew what the cosmos was like. We had no data on the distant universe and thus no way to test alternative theories. The joke among astronomers and other scientists, for that matter, used to be that cosmology was the branch of science where the ratio of theory to data was infinite. Lots of theories, no data. Now, what many people don't appreciate, and what we're going to try to tell you about tonight, is that that situation has completely changed in the last decade or so. There's now only one theory that has survived the onslaught of the tremendous amount of data that's come from wonderful instruments like these. And that theory is based on the idea that almost all of the universe is invisible. It's mostly made of something that we call dark matter and dark energy. In this talk, and also in the popular book that Nancy and I wrote, which has come out in various foreign editions, and there's more in progress, we call this theory the double dark theory, because it's based on two kinds of invisible stuff, dark matter and dark energy. It's now become the accepted standard model of modern cosmology. What's emerging is humanity's first picture of the universe as a whole, its history, and its structure that might actually be true. We are in the midst of a cosmological revolution on the same scale as the Copernican Revolution. The new cosmology explains far more than just the Big Bang. It provides an underpinning for a new global shared picture of reality, and that could possibly improve prospects for global cooperation.
In the year 1054, a new star suddenly appeared in the sky that burned so brightly you could see it in the daytime. But no one in Europe recorded this extraordinary event. In the medieval cosmology of the time, Earth was the center of the universe, and the heavens were exactly the way God made them, and they were eternally unchanging. So a new star was simply inconceivable. It just could not enter their minds. Today we know that a supernova appeared then, and in fact, here it is. Okay. And in fact,
I've already changed it.
Good. I needed my clicker here. This is its remnant. It's called the Crab Nebula. Now, we know that the supernova occurred because Chinese and other astronomers did record it. They were living in different cosmologies, different mental ways of seeing the universe. What this illustrates is that human beings only perceive things that make sense in their cosmology, because cosmology is reality. Unlike virtually every other culture in human history, and probably also prehistory, we in the modern West have no shared cosmology. We have libraries full of creation stories, but we have a culture of skepticism. So how do we picture the universe? Well, most educated secular people still picture the universe as possibly infinite and mostly empty space with celestial objects scattered throughout. This is very much the same as Isaac Newton pictured it in the 17th century. But at the same time, we all blithely exploit technologies that are based on relativity, quantum mechanics, genetic engineering, and other science that is completely inconsistent with this 17th century picture of the universe. The major threats to human survival today, world environmental degradation, extinction of species, climate destabilization, nuclear war, terrorists with weapons of mass destruction, all of these result in large part from unrestrained use of modern technologies without an accurate cosmic context in which they make sense and from which we can understand what we are doing with them. Our home planet Earth is, of course, integrated into the cosmos, but the way we think about it is not. The true effects of our modern technological activities are as invisible to us as the 1054 supernova was to the medieval Europeans. A new perspective could make all the difference. Now, without a believable story that explains the high-tech, fast-paced, dangerous world we actually live in, there is no way to actually conceptualize the big picture, and thus no way to see it. And without a big picture, we're very small people. We need a way to wrap our minds around a big picture for our time. And in this talk, we're going to outline what the scientific big picture is and then how it might turn out to be extremely useful, if not the key to our survival. The bottom line is this. Despite popular prejudice to the contrary, we humans turn out to have a very special place in the universe. But this place could not have been conceived of before modern cosmology. Earth is not geographically central. Of course, Galileo was right. But it turns out that intelligent beings are central in very interesting ways to the fundamental principles that govern the modern universe. Our bodies are midway between the largest and smallest possible sizes. We are made of the rarest material in the universe. We are at the center of the visible universe, and we are living at the midpoint of time in four different senses.
So what I'm going to do now is take us on some cosmic trips, starting where we are, the third rock from the sun, the third of the four rocky inner planets. It takes light only 8 minutes to get from the sun to us and a few hours to cross the solar system. But it takes light 100,000 years to cross the Milky Way galaxy, our cosmic home. Our solar system is located at the bottom of this first V, about halfway out from the center of the Milky Way. The Milky Way, in turn, is just one of these dots on the scale of the local supercluster. We're going to take a voyage starting at Earth, first going a certain distance across our galaxy, and then going all the way across the local supercluster to the Virgo cluster. The Virgo cluster is the richest concentration of galaxies for 100 million light years around. So that's the center of our local supercluster. We're going to start looking toward this, I hope, familiar constellation. It's Orion. There's the belt, Betelgeuse, Rigel. We're going to head for the sword. Notice this is the disk of the Milky Way, our home galaxy. Using the Hipparchus satellite, we've measured the distance to about 100,000 nearby and fairly bright stars. And all of that data has been put in the computer so that we can navigate around. We also are using telescope pictures of the Orion Nebula. That's the bright thing in the sword. As we pass the Horsehead Nebula, a dark cloud in front of a bright nebula, we're now 1,500 light years from Earth and accelerating. The Orion Nebula is lit up by the young stars that are forming in it and shine very brightly. The Rosette Nebula is another example of a stellar nursery. But not all these nebulae, that just means glowing gas clouds, are places where stars are born. This is the Crab Nebula, which, as Nancy explained, is where a star died, and it was seen on Earth as a supernova in 1054. You can see the pulsar flashing. The debris from explosions like this is all this dust that's blocking our view in the disk of the Milky Way. So let's rise up and out of the disk so we can see the grand panorama of our home galaxy. As the galaxy recedes into the distance, we see the large and small Magellanic clouds and other satellite galaxies. Everything we see now is a galaxy. Here is the great galaxy Andromeda, the other big galaxy in the local group, and the Triangulum, or M33 galaxy, a small spiral in the local group. As we go through this gas cloud in M33, we're now 2 million light years from home. Now, we are heading for the Virgo cluster, which is just coming into view on the left here. That's the Virgo cluster. But we're going to take a scenic route past some of the pretty nearby galaxies. That was M81 and M82. This is the so-called Whirlpool galaxy. Now, notice that there's a long chain of galaxies that leads into the Virgo cluster. We're going to enter this filament or chain of galaxies, and then we're going to ride down it into the Virgo cluster. What we've seen mostly are spiral galaxies, big disks of stars with sometimes a bulge in the middle. But in the Virgo cluster, there are also a lot of elliptical galaxies, and our journey ends at this giant elliptical galaxy, M87. It has an even more spectacular black hole in the center with a jet coming out of it. The black hole in the center has a mass 3 billion times the mass of our sun. It's the highest mass for a black hole that's yet been measured, although there are probably bigger ones in the universe. Well, that was just the first of our cosmic voyages.
Well, it's very helpful, actually, to have a way to grasp the enormous differences in size that exist in this universe. So we are going to introduce this symbol, and it represents the entire universe from the point of view of size. So this is what we call the cosmic Ouroboros, and it represents all the possible sizes that things can be. A serpent swallowing its tail is called an Ouroboros, and it's been used as a cosmic symbol by many cultures, so our use of it is as legitimate as any other. Now, what we've done here is we've arrayed the sizes possible logarithmically around the serpent, from the smallest size at the tip of the tail, getting larger and larger. The tip of the tail is the Planck length, and getting larger and larger until the head, which is the size of the cosmic horizon, the visible universe. So let me just say what the icons are. Joel, if you could just move over a little. So let's start from us. Here we are down here. Oh, thank you. You can point them out. So those are humans, and to the right is a mountain, and then the Earth, the sun, the size of the solar system, the distance to the Orion, the stars in Orion, the size of the galaxy, the size of the supercluster, which we just flew across, and then, of course, the size of the visible universe. Now, going around the other way from us, the next size down, there's an ant, a single-celled creature, a DNA molecule, a single atom, the nucleus of an atom, and then some exotic particles in there. And what you saw in that last video is just the range of size scales that that arrow covers. There's almost an unimaginably wide range of size scales possible, but what you should notice is that it turns out that we humans are almost exactly in the middle. And we couldn't be anywhere else, because if we were much smaller, we wouldn't have enough atoms to be complicated, to have the kind of consciousness that we do. And if we were much larger, then the speed of thought and internal communications would be limited by the speed of light, and we wouldn't be able to think. So it's really only near the center of all possible sizes that consciousness as complex as ours can exist. And this tells us something very interesting about aliens, intelligent aliens, because if they exist, they're very likely to be approximately our size. Now, I don't mean 6 feet tall, but I mean somewhere between the size of a redwood tree and a puppy. It's a very small range. But the cosmic Ouroboros actually tells much more than this.
So I'm just going to say a few things about the cosmic Ouroboros. Different forces are important on different size scales. On the largest size scale, gravity is what controls from the size of mountains on up. On the next size scale down, from mountains to atoms, it's the electrical forces and the magnetic forces, the basis of chemistry. The next size down, it's the weak and strong interactions. And on still smaller size scales, these are forces that control in the nucleus of an atom. Now, we have a very good modern theory called the Standard Model of Particle Physics.
The
Standard Model of Particle Physics describes very well the electromagnetic and weak and strong interactions, and it makes a connection between them. And it seems to fit very well all the data that we have on these size scales. But there's no room in the Standard Model of Particle Physics for dark matter, which is most of the matter in the universe. So we think that the dark matter must be associated with an even smaller size scale. Click. Thanks. And that's what this DM is all about. Now, what's this business about the snake swallowing its tail? That's the hope that if we really understand how the universe is put together, we'll see a connection between all these size scales, and in particular, between the smallest scale and the biggest scale. And if that's true, then possibly the best theoretical understanding we have of how it could happen is from superstring theory. Because it's true that in superstring theory, if you try to get smaller than the Planck scale, you get remapped into bigger scales. So there is a connection. And in fact, superstring theory could encompass all of these different forces. The trouble is that superstring theory hasn't made any testable predictions yet, so we don't really know if it's right. The one thing that we learn is that size really matters, for physics anyway. That's something that Galileo was probably the first scientist to appreciate. His last book, The Discourses in Two New Sciences, was about what we would today call the science of mechanics, how particles move, and also structural engineering. And this is the structural engineering stuff, but applied to bodies of living organisms. Galileo showed that no animal could be 3 times its normal height and stay the same shape, simply scaled up. If the height increases 3 times, the strength of the bones, if they stayed the same shape, would increase proportional to their cross-sectional area, so 3 times 3, or 9 times. But the weight of the organism would increase proportional to its volume 27 times. And the bones, only 9 times stronger, could not hold up an organism 27 times more massive. That's why the bones of a massive creature like an elephant have to be much thicker in proportion to their length than the bones of a small animal. Do you think Hollywood understands this? Actually, of course they do, because these are mechanical gadgets. No living creature could look like that.
Well, so here we are. We're at the center. Oops. Center of the cosmic Ouroboros. And the few size scales surrounding us make up our conscious world, and we've tried to show that in sunlight. And our conscious world includes the littlest creatures that humans have been able to see, maybe a gnat or a flea, up to about the size of the sun. So Joel and I decided in our book to give this range of size scales a name, and we call it Midgard. We borrowed that name from the Norse mythology of the Eddas. And Midgard on the cosmic Ouroboros is what most people think of as reality. But as you can see, it's only a small piece of reality, no more than a quarter of it. But it is a special part of reality. It's the part for which we humans have intuition. So Midgard is our mental homeland in the universe. If there are intelligent aliens, as I mentioned before, since they're probably close to our size, Midgard could very well be their mental homeland too. Now, Midgard is everywhere in the universe. Don't think of it as a place. It's not a place. It's a setting of the intellectual zoom lens, so to speak. It's the amount that we're willing and able to see at any given time. So if you traveled to a planet in a distant galaxy, 1 billion light years away, your Midgard intuition would be very useful for getting around, although, of course, it would be fallible. But if you just stay in this room and change your mental focus to any of the sizes here or here, your intuition becomes completely worthless. No one ever imagined without science how the universe began or how very small or very large things behave. They also never imagined what the universe is made of. The main components of the universe are not things we're familiar with on Earth, because Earth and we are made of stardust, the rarest material in the universe. Now, stardust is the literal term for the heavy elements because they're made in stars and they're spewed out as dust into the universe from supernovas. Only 0.01% of the universe is stardust, so that is pretty rare stuff. This is what the universe looks like to the Hubble Space Telescope. It's very beautiful, but it's very misleading as a picture of the universe because all it shows is light. And light reveals not only stardust, but stars and gas clouds. Nevertheless, all this totals up to is 0.5% of what's out there. So it's been a tremendous challenge to figure out what the universe was made of, but the reason this was essential is because the way the universe operates depends on the behavior of these specific ingredients. So here's another symbol we're going to introduce, and this represents the universe as a whole from the point of view of what it's made of. Now, this pyramid represents all visible matter, and of course you recognize it, I'm sure. We borrowed this from the back of the dollar bill. We're using it to represent the universe as a whole, but this time the volume of each section of the pyramid is proportional to the amount of that ingredient in the visible universe. The ribbon at the bottom says in Latin, the new order of the ages, and that is what this new universe picture will become.
So, coming out of the Big Bang, it's basically just hydrogen and helium, about three parts hydrogen to one part helium by mass. That's what the first stars are made of. And then those stars and the subsequent generations of stars manufacture all the other elements in the periodic table. Carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, iron, the stuff we're made of. That's then spewed out in the late stages of stellar evolution and at the ends of the life of stars, and it can be recycled into new planets and stars, and some of it ended up in us. Now, you may wonder, if this is half of 1%, what's the rest? Notice that the pyramid was sitting on the ground. Imagine that underground there's this gigantic invisible pyramid. The invisible atoms, not stars, not lit up by stars, make up about 4% of the cosmic density. But the majority of the matter, the stuff that holds our galaxy and all the other galaxies together, is not made of atoms, and it's not made of the parts of atoms. It's not made of protons, neutrons, or electrons. It's not made of quarks. It's made of something completely different. We don't know what it is. Possibly, when the Large Hadron Collider starts up later this year, they may start making it. And there are several other ways we may discover what it is in the next couple of years. But we just call it cold, dark matter because that theory, which I helped to invent, describes how it behaves. The bulk of the cosmic density isn't even any of these things. It's something else, dark energy, that makes the universe expand faster and faster.
Well, another way to think about this is imagine that the entire universe is an ocean that's filled with dark energy, this energy that powers the expansion of the universe. And on the ocean, there sail billions of ghostly ships made of dark matter. At the tips of the tallest masts of the largest ships are little tiny beacons of light hanging there. And when we look out at the universe, all we see are those beacons of light. We don't see the ships and we don't see the ocean, but we know they're there through theory, specifically the double dark theory that Joel mentioned earlier.
So why do we believe these amazing things? Well, they must sound rather crazy. The universe is almost all invisible. It's made of weird, mysterious stuff. The reason that essentially all astronomers now think that this is true is that this theory has consistently predicted successfully observations that have come in across a wide spectrum of scientific instruments. Not only those telescopes that I showed you at the beginning, including Hubble Space Telescope in space and the great ground-based telescopes like the Keck telescopes in Hawaii, but telescopes that observe the heat radiation of the Big Bang, the COBE, Cosmic Background Explorer satellite, in 1992 discovered the fluctuations on very large angular scales, down to about 7 degrees, that were exactly as predicted by the cold dark matter theory. And then starting in 2003, the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe has produced these amazing maps of the slightly cooler in blue and slightly hotter in red directions around us. So this is actually the sphere that surrounds us of the heat radiation of the Big Bang. And in slightly different directions, the temperatures are different by a few millionths of a degree. If you analyze the typical size scales of these differences in temperature, you get this graph. The white dots are the measurements by COBE on big scales and the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe across down to a scale of about a tenth of a degree. This continues to smaller scales with ground-based observations. The wiggly line is the prediction of the double dark theory, and this prediction was made a decade or more before any of this data became available. And every single point is exactly as predicted. There are no discrepancies. This shows that the double dark theory explains the Big Bang. But it also, the very same theory, describes the distribution of matter on all size scales that we can measure astronomically, from smaller than galaxies, to clusters of galaxies, all the way out to the cosmic horizon. The very same theory. And in fact, it predicts the existence, the size range of galaxies, the distribution of galaxies. There are no known discrepancies between the predictions of this theory and any of the observations in the universe on large scales. That's why we take it so seriously.
Pretty serious. So here's this drunk. He's sitting on the stoop, and he says to his friend, oh, quarks, neutrinos, mesons, all those damn particles you can't see. That's what drove me to drink. But now I can see them. And now we, too, can see what can't be seen, the dark matter. So I'm saying this to introduce the next video because sometimes it confuses people. The video that you saw before was based on light. You saw actual pictures from Hubble Space Telescope, but no light ever comes from dark matter. We can only detect it through its gravitational effects. So this is going to be a supercomputer simulation that you see, and what looks bright and sparkling is actually totally invisible. We're using brightness to represent density. So the brighter a region is in the next video, the denser the dark matter is, but really it's all totally invisible.
So this is an example of how a little region of the universe would grow and grow into the size that it is today. If we showed it that way, though, you wouldn't be able to see what was going on until it got pretty big. So what we're not going to show is the expansion of the universe. We're going to blow all of these pictures up to the same size. In the video that I'm about to show, we're going to rotate the whole picture slowly so that you can see the three-dimensional effect. And there's also going to be a clock in the lower left corner, the billions of years ago that the picture represents. So this simulation is actually one that was run by Brandon Allgood when he was doing his PhD work with me. And we used what was then NASA's most powerful computer, the Columbia supercomputer, named after the ill-fated space shuttle. I've actually just finished a new simulation that's 1,000 times bigger and even has higher resolution. And we're just in the process of visualizing that. That's done with an even bigger supercomputer, NASA's current most powerful machine, one of the most powerful machines in the world. Now, what you can see is that these galaxies are strung out along filaments. And where the filaments cross, there are great clusters of galaxies. The distribution of galaxies predicted by the theory looks exactly like what you saw in that video that I showed at the beginning, the voyage across the local supercluster. Let's now go out to an even larger scale. The voyage across the local supercluster was a distance of about 60 million light years from our galaxy to the Virgo cluster. This map down at the bottom, which is produced by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, shows what's happening on a scale of a billion and more light years. So let's look at the distribution of a million galaxies and 100,000 quasars out to many tens of billions of light years. So we're rapidly backing away from the local supercluster. All these galaxies have been mapped, and the project is still going on. When We're now out about 1 billion light years. Now 2 billion light years as these red luminous galaxies come in. What you can begin to see is the walls of galaxies surrounding regions with very, very few galaxies. Cosmic voids surrounded by walls of galaxies. Incidentally, the music, both for this video and the previous one, was composed and performed by Nancy. Now, to really get a sense of how the galaxies are distributed, we rotate the image. We've only mapped slices of the sky. As you see the slices go by, what you realize is it looks like slices of a sponge. Now we're backing away and seeing the quasars in blue. And now we're outside the Big Bang, with the help of a computer, of course. This is the heat radiation of the Big Bang as mapped by the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, with the galaxies in proper register in the inside, the mapped galaxies.
Time is a fundamental characteristic of the universe, and this is probably the single most important for our everyday lives. So this is the last symbol we're going to use tonight. This is what Joel and I call the cosmic spheres of time. This also represents the universe as a whole, but this time only from the point of view of time. Our galaxy is at the center. When we look out in space, we look back in time. Why is that? We see because light hits our eyes carrying a reflection of its source. Light travels through space at a fixed speed of 186,000 miles per second. It's fast, but it's finite. So when we look through telescopes, we see galaxies as they were when the light that's reaching our eyes now left them. So the farther away that the galaxies are, the earlier that light that we're seeing now left them. So we're seeing those galaxies at an earlier stage in the history of the universe. So these concentric spheres don't represent just space. They represent time, and each sphere, as you move outward, represents an earlier and earlier time in the history of the universe, with the outermost sphere representing the Big Bang.
So
we're at the
center.
As
Nancy said, this central galaxy represents our Milky Way. The next sphere out represents the sphere of light that's just reaching us today, that left when our sun and the Earth and the solar system were formed about 4.5 billion years ago. The next sphere out represents about 10 billion years ago when big galaxies like our own were first starting to form. And you'll see that all the galaxies in here, these are blow-ups of images from the Hubble Deep Field, the ultra-deep field. These look pretty much like the nearby galaxies. But if you look beyond this sphere, the galaxies don't look like the nearby galaxies at all. They're oddly shaped. They also have funny colors. These are also images from the ultra-deep field from Hubble Space Telescope. And we only see these galaxies out to this sphere about 600 million years after the Big Bang. Before that, the universe had not been lit up by galaxies. We call it the cosmic dark ages. The next sphere out is that very colorful sphere of the cosmic background radiation, where the colors represent slight differences in temperature. And the last sphere is the Big Bang itself, or the cosmic horizon, beyond which we can't see even in principle.
Well, unlike the last video where you ended up looking at the universe from the outside with that computer simulation, if we want to get an accurate sense of our own place in the universe, we have to start looking at it from the inside, which is where we are. So the cosmic spheres of time place us at the center, but it's still drawn as if it's up there on the screen and we're all out here just looking at it. So in your imagination, take your place at the center. Put yourself in the center of this picture and close those spheres around yourself. And when you do that, you realize you are immersed in the history of the universe. our place in the modern universe is not a literal geographic spot. It's a philosophical place that's created by the interaction of space, time, light, and consciousness. Because without consciousness, there's no visible universe. The cosmic spheres of time are real because evidence of them, in the form of light, is arriving all the time. And this is, in fact, what makes astronomy even possible.
So let's look again at this lovely image, the deepest image that Hubble Space Telescope has yet taken, and appreciate something I didn't mention before, which is that there will never again be so many galaxies visible. Now is the peak moment in the history of the universe for astronomical observation, because as the universe expands faster and faster, the most distant galaxies are disappearing over the cosmic horizon. We astronomers tell the funding agencies, "Fund us quick!" In addition, so this is a special time because it's the time when the universe stopped slowing down and started speeding up. In addition, this is the middle of the lifetime of the solar system. The solar system started about 4.5 billion years ago. It's got 5 or 6 billion years to go before the sun, heating up, increasing its luminosity steadily, becomes a red giant star, swallows the inner planets, burns Earth to a crisp. About 5 or 6 billion years. We also live at the middle of the best period of Earth, this white band. Earth got an oxygen-rich atmosphere about 500 million years ago. And that's when all the large creatures began to come into existence on Earth. In about 500 million years, the increasing temperature of the sun is going to evaporate all the water, and the water will be dissociated by ultraviolet light from the sun at the top of the atmosphere, and the hydrogen will be permanently lost. And if anything survives, it'll be microbes. This will be the conversion of Earth into a dune planet. Unless our descendants steadily move Earth further away from the sun, which can be done by altering the orbit of large comets, a space engineering project that is definitely going to be within the capabilities of our descendants in possibly a century or so. You can ask me more about that afterwards. We face, however, a much more pressing problem. This is the Earth's population, and in the last century, it increased by a factor of 4. That never happened before, and it can't happen again. I don't think anyone thinks Earth can even support twice the current population, let alone 4 times. So we have to decide, we humans, over the next decades, what the future is going to be of the human population. Will it crash or level out? Or maybe even slowly decrease. Even more amazing than this exponential increase in the human population in the last couple of centuries is the increase in our technological impact on the planet. The population has increased by a factor of 6 in the last 2 centuries, from 1800 to 2000. The gross world product increased by a factor of 100. And incidentally, it's another factor of 2 since then, just in the last 9 years. Primary energy by a factor of 30. Carbon dioxide emissions by a factor of 20. Mobility, in terms of kilometers moved per person per day, by a factor of 1,000. In many ways, these are wonderful things. They make our lives so much nicer. But if you extrapolate this into the future, there are all kinds of problems. Americans, of course, are the biggest consumers of all. People in the U.S. consume their weight in resources every single day. For the rest of the world to use resources at this rate would take at least 4 more planet Earths. We only have 1.
America, we have come so far. We have seen so much. But there's so much more to do. So tonight, let us ask ourselves, if our children should live to see the next century, if my daughters should be so lucky to live as long as Ann Nixon Cooper, what change will they see? What progress will we have made? This is our chance to answer that call. This is our moment. This is our time.
This was that wonderful speech that then-President-elect Obama gave on election night. And he was laying down a challenge, really, to us to start thinking seriously on a much longer time scale than we ever have before. And we might name this time scale the Malia Sasha horizon, because he did compare it to the age of his children. I mean, he said if his children lived to be as old as Ann Nixon Cooper, who I think was 105 or 106. So the Malia Sasha horizon is an interesting idea because it's not just an abstract 100 years. It's actually the lifetimes of these two little girls. And Malia and Sasha, for their whole lives, are going to represent the current elementary school generation, their characteristics as they get older. The year 2108 is an inescapably real time that will occur for these little girls and their classmates. Even though many adults today economically discount that as a low probability event. It's not a low probability event, it's a certainty. And expanding our thinking out to the Malia Sasha horizon would be a first step toward a cosmological perspective. In 1975, as Brandon mentioned, I was a young lawyer working at the Office of Technology Assessment of the U.S. Congress. That was the Science Advisory Office, and it had been started in 1972 to provide Congress with independent science advice. But it was sadly abolished in 1995 by the Republican Revolution. Now, in OTA in the 70s, we all knew that the Earth was warming, we knew that oil was running out, we knew that our healthcare system was unsustainable. Our job was to think in the long term. But in Washington, where decisions are very often made with an eye to the next election, regardless of the length of the consequences, no one in power actually took us seriously. And they felt that 30 years was an absurdly luxurious and unrealistic timeline. The result is that now those 30 years have passed, and every one of those problems has gotten worse. Now, no one can predict what the country is going to be like when Malia and Sasha are old, but we have an absolute obligation today to consider the likely impacts of our own decisions and our own behavior, at least out to the Malia-Sasha horizon.
The U.S. government just released this report, Global Climate Change Impacts in the United States. You can download it from the web. These are all figures from that report. So what this shows is the amount of carbon dioxide in air trapped in little bubbles in ice cores from Antarctica going back 800,000 years, the carbon dioxide was never higher than 300 parts per million. When it was up near 300, it was a warm period. When it was down at the 200 level, it was an ice age. Today, it's 385 parts per million and rising extremely rapidly. And you can see that for the last couple of decades, the temperature increase has tracked the increase in carbon dioxide. At the Malia-Sasha horizon, 2100 roughly, the most optimistic scenario has it increasing to about 550 parts per million, almost twice the highest it's been for the last 800,000 years. The scenario based on business as usual has it increasing to 900 parts per million, three times what it's been for the last 800,000 years. The pessimistic scenario is labeled A2. These are scenarios in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change 2007 report. Their most optimistic, potentially realistic scenario is labeled B1. And You see that B1 has a peak in carbon dioxide emission globally around 2040 and then declines dramatically by a factor of 2 since after that, whereas A2 continues to rise. The consequence is that the total amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere levels out at about 500 parts per million in B1, but keeps increasing. And as you see, the even more pessimistic scenarios reach 900 parts per million. The consequence for the temperature is there's been a temperature increase of 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit, about 1 degree Celsius, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. But for B1, the temperature would increase by about 3 degrees Fahrenheit. For these pessimistic scenarios, it'll be maybe 7, 8, something like that. Now, how are we doing? This is the scenario. This is the optimistic one in blue, the pessimistic one in the most pessimistic in magenta. This is the actual CO2 emission that's been tracked. We're above even the most pessimistic projections of a decade ago. That's how we're doing. So this is the report's figures for the temperature about the middle of this century across the United States. 3 or 4 degree temperature increase. That's the optimistic scenario. And at the end of the century, the Malia-Sasha horizon, across a lot of the country, including the breadbasket, it's a lot hotter. That was the optimistic scenario. This is the pessimistic scenario. This is the middle of the century. This is the end of the century. 10 degrees across the country. What does that mean? It means that Illinois either gets the climate of Tennessee in the middle of the century or Arkansas, and then Arkansas or Texas by the end of the century. Well, that's where corn used to come from. What about the West? This is the optimistic scenario at the end of the century. This is the pessimistic scenario. The Southwest is projected to have 20 to 40% less precipitation than it does now. These are some of the consequences of just one aspect of this huge technological impact that humans are beginning to have on the planet.
Well, actually, though, there's no law of physics that says we have to fail. It's all a matter of human choices. And for the world to achieve sustainable prosperity in the age of electronics and information should not really be that hard. We could actually survive for hundreds of millions of years if we just get through the next few decades in a sane way. But today's 17th century picture of the universe actually psychologically discourages people from seeing the long-term consequences of their actions, because in that picture, space goes on immeasurably, and no place is central or special, and so we humans seem to be insignificant specks. Here's a mythologist Joseph Campbell who said, humanity is just a scurf on the epidermis of a small planet of an average star. Here's the famous biologist Stephen Jay Gould who said, humans are merely a fortuitous cosmic afterthought. Here, this is so common, this idea that we're just nothing important is so common that here it is in Peanuts. Now, Snoopy says, you're of no importance. Did you know that? You're just the tiniest speck in an enormous universe. Poor Snoopy takes that in and says, then I might as well go back to sleep. Isn't that what we're doing? And here it is again in Calvin and Hobbes. What a clear night. Look at the stars, millions of them. Yes, we're just tiny specks on a planet particle hurling through the infinite blackness. Let's go in and turn on all the lights. But all these people who think that we are insignificant specks in the universe are wrong.
Because we are at the center of our cosmic spheres of time. And we're made of the rarest stuff in the universe. That eye at the top of the cosmic density pyramid represents intelligent life, which has to be made of the rarest stuff, namely heavy elements, stardust. We live in the middle of all possible sizes, where the possibility of tremendous variety and complexity coming in small packages keeps life interesting. Life of our complexity could bloom nowhere else on the cosmic Ouroboros. As you see, I'm summing up. We live at the midpoint of time, which is also the peak moment in the entire evolution of the universe for astronomical observation. The most distant galaxies, which we've just acquired the technological ability to see, are beginning to disappear over the cosmic horizon now that the once slowing expansion of the universe has begun instead to accelerate. We live at the midpoint in the life of our planet. It formed along with the Sun and the other planets about 4.5 billion years ago. It has about 6 billion years to go before it is roasted when our Sun swells into a red giant star. Complex life evolved 0.5 billion years ago and has about 0.5 billion years to go until the warming Sun overheats the Earth, unless billions of years if our planets move the Earth farther from the Sun.
Cosmic perspective is partly a matter of knowledge and it's partly a matter of choice. Scientific cosmology doesn't tell anybody anything, really, about how humans should behave. It just tells us how the universe works. The choice that we have is whether to see it as just an interesting activity or whether to take it seriously as an accurate map of reality, all of reality, including our lives and decisions. Romantics are made of stardust, but cynics are made of the nuclear waste of dead stars. Both views are equally scientifically accurate, but they have tremendously different implications for how we see our lives. Why fight to save humanity if we feel we're just a bunch of nuclear waste? Humans and our planet are stardust evolving into awesome complexity over billions of years in an evolving universe shaped by dark matter and dark energy. Each of us has a multi-billion year past in us, and we need to start thinking of our legacy on the same scale, not only protecting the environment of Earth, but laying the foundations for a just and long-lived global civilization.
A new cosmology has the power to overturn the fundamental institutions of society. This is, in fact, what happened in the last cosmological revolution on the scale of this one, the Copernican-Newtonian revolution. That revolution overthrew the medieval cosmology of the heavenly spheres. It undercut rigid social and religious hierarchies of medieval society that had been justified by their picture of the heavens. And soon, the divine right of kings was challenged, and reigning monarchs lost not only their thrones, but their heads, first in England and then in France. This is the kind of practical consequence that can result from a change in cosmology.
Over the coming years, many more people may begin to recognize that if we want to protect ourselves and the rest of humanity, we have to open our minds to the possibility of an overarching, unifying cosmological vision for Earth that can help us humans with all of our small divisions and our big emotions to cooperate for the long-term survival of our descendants. This vision would not impose a single way of thinking on everyone's lives. Human beings are endlessly diverse. I mean, that's our forte. But as the cosmic Ouroboros shows, on different size scales, different rules control what happens. So what this suggests is that we can preserve diversity on the level of everyday lifestyles while finding consensus about the nature of the planet and the universe. This kind of a meaningful science-based cosmology could turn out to be the practical knowledge that lets us make sense for the first time of both the threats and the opportunities of what President Obama called this defining moment. So if we wake up to the reality of our universe, we wake up to our present predicament on Earth, if we become willing to expand our interpretations of our religions, for example, to encompass this new knowledge, if we begin to teach this new picture of the universe to our children and to integrate its principles into our thinking and our art, then we could have a new enlightenment and we could become ancestors worthy of honor 1,000 years from now. What science has made clear is that we are at the center of a vast cosmic adventure. We are not outside it and not at its end. So think cosmically, act globally, eat locally. Thank you.
Thank you. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you've been listening to A Cosmic View of the Human Future with Nancy Abrams and Joel Premack. Our thanks to Nancy Abrams and Joel Premack for their comments this evening. I'm Brandon Allgood, the Vice Chair of the Science and Technology Member-Led Forum here at the Club. And I think based on the time, we probably can take one question. You guys get to choose the lucky person, and I will pass them the mic.
You sure? Nancy and Joel, you made the comment that if we could get over the next few decades, that the prognosis might be quite good. If you had to outline with some specificity what measures you would see from a political and scientific standpoint could help us get through those few decades, what would those be?
Well, as Nancy said, you have to take science seriously. And I'd say that one of our greatest difficulties is that in the United States and certain other countries, a lot of the population either doesn't know or doesn't understand or doesn't want to pay attention to the basic facts that science is teaching us about the Earth and our impact on it. So this is a democracy. The electorate finally is responsible for the decisions that get made. And we are in a race between ignorance and knowledge, if you like. And I hope that knowledge wins. There are, of course, lots of political and economic and social details, but we don't have time, and I don't have the expertise to discuss them. So from my point of view, the most important thing is that people have to start learning how the Earth really works and paying attention to what we're learning from the scientists who work on those kinds of problems and also seeing how the Earth fits into the larger universe. It would also be helpful, one last thing, to start to articulate a vision for where we should be in not just 10 years, but the Malias-Asha horizon. Really think through what we can realistically expect and accomplish. And I think that could help to motivate people.
People hate to be suckers. More than anything else, that's what they hate. So nobody wants to be the first person to change. Nobody wants to say, well, I'm going to give up A, B, and C, even though everybody else isn't doing it. Because then they think, well, everyone else is going to be benefiting and not me, and I'll be the sucker here. We can't have that. We somehow have to make this change communally. And I think that what we need is what we might call a cosmic society. We need to have people who are willing to join together to figure out, well, what are the implications of this science for our politics? We need people discussing this kind of thing and taking very seriously that we have an obligation to think not just 100 years, but 1,000 years into the future. People trying to dispose of nuclear waste have to think 100,000 years into the future. This is not pure speculation. This is reality, and we have an obligation. And the thing is that once a group of people gets together and take seriously the idea that we really could develop a new way of looking not just at what to do on Earth, but what we human beings even are. We are part of something huge and absolutely thrilling, which is this evolving universe, which we now know we have a place in. When people get together as a group to discuss that, they find a power as a group to start making changes and to be willing to take on this responsibility to start, to begin, to not feel that they're a sucker. And I think we have seen this happen with multiple groups who have been discussing our book. We've been invited to some of these discussions. The fact is, people have to start. And the ones who are willing to start are the ones who realize that a vision is not just powerful, but exciting and something that they want to be part of. I think that that's going to be the basis of it. People need a payback. No one's going to step out there otherwise.
All right. Well, join me in thanking Joel and Nancy. I would just like to quickly remind everyone, this has been a program of the Commonwealth Club of California enjoying its 106th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.